Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
People and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Reuben Stern. If you've stepped foot in downtown Columbia over the past several months, you've no doubt noticed a lot of building in the works. Altogether, a string of construction projects in the area will add several hundred apartments, most of them geared toward college students. The boom in downtown building is one piece of accommodating an ever-growing population in Columbia. According to a note that was sent out recently over a community listserv by Paul Sturtz, a former city council member, if the current trends continue, the city may need to add housing for about 3,000 people each year over the next decade. Meanwhile, university enrollment continues to increase. One big question is what the influx of downtown residents might mean for Columbia, particularly if the majority of those residents downtown are students. The building boom also raises questions about how the current downtown development fits with what the community hopes will happen in the heart of the city. Here today to discuss the future of downtown Columbia, Carrie Gartner is the executive director of the Downtown Community Improvement District. Welcome to the program, Carrie Gartner.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in today. We also have with us John Ott. He is a developer and the owner of Alley A Realty. He also owns several downtown properties, including the Stevens Building on Broadway and Hitt, which he recently bought. Welcome to the program, John Ott.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us as well. We also have with us today Deb Shields. She is a historic preservation consultant. She's also a past chair and a founding member of the Columbia Historic Preservation Commission. Welcome to the program, Deb Shields.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us as well. We hope to hear from you and our audience, too. What's your vision for downtown Columbia? Give us a call. Share your thoughts. 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And let's start with this question. You know, suddenly there's all this student housing development downtown. And as one of my colleagues asked me earlier today, did we miss the memo or something? Like, what happened here?
You know, I think traditionally Columbia has been underserved when it comes to residential. Typically, 1-2% of a city's population wants to live downtown, and we've had maybe 150 apartments for many, many years. So we've seen an increase in student housing and other types of housing, and I know John's been involved in a lot of that development.
What happened, though? I mean, John, you have developed a lot of apartments downtown sort of previous to this sudden boom. What went on here? Why are we suddenly seeing all these massive apartment buildings? Massive may be an overstatement. Big apartment buildings.
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, we haven't done that many. We have a handful of apartments that we primarily lease to young adults or empty nesters, mainly because there tends to be less effects on the property, and they don't people don't move out annually. Usually they stay longer. So, but why is there such a demand for student housing? And by the way, I think there's a demand for all housing downtown. I don't think it's just students, but I don't know. I think it's happening all around the country. I think there's the desire for urban living has increased. I think people just want to be around their restaurants and shopping and they like the idea that they can walk to places and not have to get in a car. So I don't know. Maybe if some of it relates to some of the popular television shows like, you know, Friends and so on. I'm not sure, you know, but it's clear that there are that there's a huge demand. And again, not just students, but young adults and people typically whose kids have left home for college or have moved on, and so the demand is real.
Well, I think John's helped show that it can be done as well. Some of the historic preservation work that John's done, that the Atkins family did, you know, it seemed like for a while everyone was afraid to do development on the second floors of downtown buildings that were existing because they thought it was too hard to get through the codes to meet modern standards. And a lot of those spaces were sitting empty. And once a few apartments came online and people saw that it could be done, the demand was certainly there. And once those were successful, then people started looking at how we could do new construction to match that.
And what switch? I mean, if there's always been this demand for living downtown, why is – I mean, in terms of the historic reservation renovations, that sort of makes sense. But what switched so that suddenly there are new construction going on?
There kind of has to be someone that, I don't know, blazes new ground. And I think certainly with historic preservation, the Atkins and John Ott are two people who kind of proved to everyone else, like Deb said, that it could be done. I think the Odels really started developing one section of 10th and Locust. And I think they were leased almost instantly on their announcement. I mean, they kind of proved to people that there was a market out there for urban downtown living. And so now everything falls into place. It kind of snowballs. And that's how development usually occurs. You get one person that proves it can work, and then it snowballs from there.
Okay. Just remind everyone, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the future of downtown Columbia. Joining me in the studio are Carrie Gartner, the executive director of the Downtown Community Improvement District, John Ott, a developer and owner of several downtown properties, and Debbie Shields, a historic preservation consultant. For those of you in our audience, if you could change one thing about downtown Columbia, what might that be? What would you like to see happen in that area? Share your thoughts. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. We'd like to remind you that Intersection takes place every Monday at 2 on KBIA and online at kbia.org. You can join our online chat at that time by going to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. In terms of the way that this is shaking out downtown, you know, the majority of these new units are student apartments, right?
Yes, definitely.
And is that in line with what downtown wants itself to be?
We're surrounded by three colleges, so really that's kind of a given when we all do things throughout the district, whether it's recruiting businesses, recruiting people to build residential. We understand that that's something that is kind of the fabric of our downtown. I think we work hard to do balance. I think when we recruit businesses, I think when you look at apartments, we do our best to create that balance, even though we do have those three colleges that really drive a lot of the market.
And what about the businesses downtown? I mean, are the students the kind of customers that the businesses downtown are hoping to attract?
Yeah, I would. You lease to a lot of businesses who...
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt the students are very important to the businesses and the restaurants downtown. But balance is going to be the key. I mean, we're excited. I think we're all excited when a developer says they want to put up a tall building downtown. But I think there has to be some consideration as we move forward as to use. Anytime you have an apartment building that has 3 and 4 bedroom units, then you know that's going to be student housing. And that's great. We need student housing. We're glad to have it downtown. However, you know, we really, I hope to see a number of 1-bedroom and 2-bedroom apartment complexes, because then there's a greater chance that you'll see rooms or apartments for faculty and business owners and just people who want to, adults and who may have more discretionary income. Now, students have a lot of discretionary income, but certainly we'd like to see a balance downtown.
Right. And what would it take for that to happen? I mean, right now, you know, most of the construction is 4-bedroom apartments, as you said. What would have to change in order for there to be more of those other types of construction going on?
Well, I mean, I think the developers will need to, and probably already do, recognize there's a market for that. There's not only a market for adults to be leasing apartment units, but for buying them. I mean, we do have a project that somebody's doing. Peckham and Bob Groves, Nick Peckham and Bob Groves, and it's going to be some of the units I believe they're selling as condos. So
and that's the residential project adjacent or within the Short Street Garage,
exactly
in the Arts District.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, those things feed off each other, too. If you get enough students down here, if you get the residential population up, maybe we can have enough of a demand to get a grocery store. So, you know, that they can all kind of feed off each other. Right now, we don't have quite enough residential to support some of those kind of services that I see in other cities I work in. A downtown grocery store is always a big one. And if you don't have enough people that are going to go there, you can't get them there. But then if you don't have it, some people won't come. So the two work together. And I think as it gets more mature and more diverse, then it becomes more attractive for upscale.
And where's the threshold going to be for that?
For the grocery store?
Sure.
Downtown St. Louis has 13,000 residents. They had one grocery store that was subsidized by their downtown association, and now Schnucks is coming in, understanding that they're going to run that grocery store at a loss. Margins are very narrow in the grocery business. So instead, we do really well with specialty markets. We have the root cellar, which is local, organic vegetables, meats, fruits. We've got Chong's Oriental Market. We've got ANY, Middle Eastern Market. So we're doing specialty markets. It's going to be a while before we get to the point where we have enough residential to really support what we typically think of as a grocery store. Right.
And what happened with that? Because Columbia used to have a grocery store near the downtown area. I mean, it's now the Office Depot, right?
Gosh, that was...
It was a long time ago.
And really, that's one of the things that our downtown has an advantage over maybe some others is that we do have surrounding neighborhoods that could also use a downtown grocery store. We probably won't have to wait till we get 13,000 units right in within our, 10 by 10 block, urban area. We can count on North Central and Grasslands, all of those neighborhoods, hopefully, to support a grocery store when it finally happens.
And they do. Urban grocery stores tend to have a different model. They have a higher proportion of prepared foods. There's a great market in downtown Springfield, which isn't too much larger than we are, that's done very well with that model of more prepared foods, but also good fresh grocery. And they've got upscale lofts in the building above it.
Smaller. Not the huge parking lot that we normally associate with large grocery stores because there's just not the space. So it definitely is a different model structurally.
Yeah, it's not like we would want someone to come and pave part of a block and make a suburban center.
Carrie, you mentioned that in St. Louis, the Downtown Association helped subsidize the presence of that grocery store.
They've got quite a bit of money. Yes.
Is that something that Columbia would ever consider or that somehow might happen here in order to get that happening?
You know, I think right now we've really looked at the market, and when the market calls for something, I think we've got some great businesses that really kind of step in to fill that niche. And I think the Root Cellar over in the North Village Arts District is a good example that they kind of really stepped in, and they're carrying a lot of products that are not just the local meats and vegetables. They're carrying shelf products that people usually need at grocery stores. So I think market-wise, there's a little bit of adaptation going on with the local businesses to really meet that demand. I think that financially, that's a big step to take in terms of subsidizing a particular business.
Right. In terms of getting people into the downtown thing, Columbia has been through two sets of consultants talking about what should or might happen downtown. In 2007, we had the Sasaki
just two
plan. Well, I mean, two big ones, let's put it that way. But you would know better than I would.
One a week.
Yes. Yes.
But, you know, there was a big consulting plan that came out in 2007 called the Sasaki plan that had one vision for downtown. And then in 2010, there was the H3 consultants came out with another more detailed plan for some specific areas of downtown. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the progression of those plans and how that's playing out. Are we seeing those plans actually occur now?
Here's what I can say. I think when it comes down to it, at heart, all the plans have the same goals in mind. It's high density, highly walkable, connected neighborhoods within the district, a mix of residential, a mix of strong retail and restaurant, and then kind of a hotel convention center component. So I think everyone's looking at our downtown, and although the specifics or the geographical area may be a little different, I think at heart they're all saying the same things. And all what they're doing is describing what makes a great urban area. And I think we're seeing that happen. If you look back to 05, was it 05 when Watkins Roofing Company was over on Orr Street and it was a light industrial area and nothing was happening there? Now it's an arts district with residential and art galleries and music venues. So I definitely see it happening. It may not happen exactly the way a consultant said it should happen, but I think we're getting that density and that liveliness to our downtown.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I think in existing buildings, we are certainly using all of the square footage, and whether it be lower levels or taking space that wasn't didn't have a great use and converting it to great uses. But then we come back again to new construction. And there was a percentage, a ghastly percentage of downtown that is surface parking lots. I think Nick Peckham did a study on it a few years ago, and you'd fall over when you heard the percentage. It might have been as much as 50%.
It was about 50 or 60% was parking.
And so you say, well, where will the future growth be? And we all talk about growth going up, and so so there we have to, what kind of buildings do we want? What will the uses be? And we've had some buildings go up over the last few years, and they've been okay, But when you have a downtown area that might be, again, 10 blocks by 10 blocks, I'm sure I'm not entirely accurate there, but roughly.
We're about 43 square blocks.
Well, there we go. Okay. All right. Let's see.
And growing, right? Because each consultant makes the area bigger.
Bigger, yeah.
You really have – there's a limited amount of space. We are surrounded by neighborhoods, and we're surrounded by the colleges. And so you want these buildings to be attractive. You want the uses to be compatible with these studies, which I think what I've learned from them is that you want uses on the first floors that are more of what Kerry mentioned, the retail, music places, just active, vibrant things going on the first levels. Once you go above that, you can have offices, you can have residential use. I know the one building that's being constructed currently on 9th Street next to Chipotle. Apparently, they're going to have all three uses, first floor commercial uses and offices and residential. So that's the type of mixed-use buildings that I hope we see a lot of downtown. So we'll have to see. And then the other thing is, it's just what are they going to look like? A lot of times you see the renderings, I don't know if you can really determine from a rendering what the building's going to look like. And a lot of times sometimes we're happy and sometimes we're not when it's actually built. And so,
yeah. Well, let's talk about that a little bit. How influential are these plans that these consultants make in terms of dictating what actually happens to the land? I mean, we see these plans and it looks great, and then we see buildings start springing up that are not necessarily in line with that.
It's difficult for the consultant to tell a private property owner, you need to put on this piece of property X. That's because that private property owner is going to say, how much money do I have? What do I want to put there? What's the market going to bear? But on a whole, I think, again, there's some overarching standards that these plans are telling us that people are doing, like more residential. And I think when the Short Street Garage came in with the renovated Regency Hotel, that was part of a consultant's plan. And so they used that plan to really promote the development.
But remember that those plans are big picture. Those were not plans to say buildings should look like this. Those were plans to say this general area lends itself well to residential. This area may be better for this. So those are pretty broad brush.
And they're inspirational.
They are. They're inspirational. And they have helped, if someone comes in and they're thinking about how should I invest my money, they can look at those plans and say, okay, a couple of different consultants have said we've got a market for residential. This would be a good area for it. So, don't expect them to do everything, but they were a great start to get the conversation going.
Right. But we have a plan that we developed years ago where for business recruitment. So we send different businesses to different sections of the district. we direct a lot of the arts-oriented ones, obviously, up into the North Village. And there's, I think, retail and is corridor is Broadway and a little bit of Ninth. So you kind of use that for suggestions for mm-hmm. people.
Okay, again, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the future of downtown Columbia. Joining me in the studio are Carrie Gartner, Executive Director of the Downtown Community Improvement District, John Ott, a developer and owner of several downtown properties, and Debbie Shields, a historic preservation consultant. For those of you in our audience, what attracts you to or potentially keeps you away from downtown Columbia? Share your thoughts. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. We have a comment in our chat room online. Again, you can go to kbia.org, follow our link to Intersection. This comment is somebody from who says, I'm retired, living on a limited income. I'd love to live near downtown or in downtown. If some affordable senior apartments were available, I'd also love to see less traffic downtown, which could be accomplished by better transportation. So two sort of questions in there. One, this affordable housing question of downtown. Let's talk about that for a minute. Most of these new developments are student housing, which when you look at the price tag for these student houses, I would be hard-pressed to live in one of these yeah. apartments, and I'm paid a salary. I mean, it's really interesting to see kind of
right.
where these things are getting priced at. The private apartments that are being built are similarly high-priced apartments. So what about that? What about a downtown where you have affluent students and affluent non-students, and that's the resident base?
Well, I lived over on 9th Street, and it was about $400 a month. But that was, you know, you have to look for those. So there's little pockets of those highly affordable spaces. I agree, though. I think that we are completely underserved all across the board when it comes to residential. And this is a good example.
Well, building up is going to help. But the land is very expensive, just the parcels of land. So, and it might be a while before you can be in a high-rise apartment and make it super affordable. Thankfully, we have the North Central neighborhood and some other neighborhoods where, as Carrie points out, you know, that's affordable housing, and it is on the edge of downtown or in the central city. And so that might be the best opportunity for people until there's such a supply to where the prices potentially come down. I don't know. Right. But transportation, I think, is huge. I think we're have a lot of work to do there. I don't think we serve the downtown area with transportation the way we should. And I know there are people looking at it, which is great. There are some people, sharp people, a lot of people looking at how to do it better. And so I'm definitely thankful for that because right now we don't do it. I mean, we were having a conversation with some folks today on Walnut, and during the course of the 10 or 15 minutes that we were actually talking about transportation, we stopped and I pointed out, you know, in other markets, you would have seen a couple of shuttles going by during the course of that conversation, and here they just don't exist. And so,
and we were standing outside the bus station at the time we had that conversation.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
Yeah, I mean, public transportation in Columbia, that may be an entire separate program we could have here to talk about that. Because that obviously is a big issue. It does raise another issue, though, related to this downtown living. You know, the mayor was on KFRU last week, I think, talking about students downtown. And one of the benefits of that potentially is that, you know, the students would bike or walk to campus. We wouldn't have all these cars driving every day on the roads. But that doesn't mean they wouldn't have cars, right?
They need to park their cars someplace
right.
so that when they leave downtown, although we don't encourage that when they actually decide to leave downtown, they have a place. But yeah, it's parking.
You have to have a car.
You have to, yeah, you can walk, you can bike around the district, but you need to have some place to garage your car.
Well, I mean, my son goes to University of Minnesota in Minneapolis, and he doesn't have a car there because it's inconvenient. And the kids that do, I think pay a lot of money to park their car someplace, and much more than the $50 a month. But a lot of universities are going to parking lots that are away from the campus and away from the downtown that might house a car, and then you can shuttle the kids in. And then they rely on the public transportation. I mean, if they're driving from, you know, one city to another or back home, you know, during break or one thing, that's one thing. But the idea that you have to house 34,000 students' cars, you know, within 30 feet of their bedroom is become an antiquated idea. You know, we really need to find a way to get people to use a bus system and have one that really does super serve the downtown area, first of all, and then the central city, and then probably, you know, other areas. But I think you have to super serve those areas first. And the culture that we have right now with our cars has to shift, at least within the central part of the city and the university.
Although I hear that and I understand that, and a lot of people would push back at that, though, and say, but we live in a time when everyone does have their cars. And that's one of the things that people are not going to let go of easily. And so it's a very sort of prescriptive way of building on the one hand. One of the questions that might come from that argument is, well, why aren't these buildings required to think about this parking situation as part of the plan for the building? Like, for example, underground parking or stacked parking with the building on top or any of those things. Why does that not come into the mix?
That is an excellent question.
Well, I'm sure.
Well, you know, you want affordable housing, right? Then if you start putting cars and garages in them, it's going to be even more expensive. I mean, we're happy for the development that's taking place, the housing developments, and if you start having the house cars in them as well, the price will even be more expensive. And so, that's the issue. And no one's been forcing anyone to put garages in them, just because of that. And really, how many garages can a downtown the size of ours hold? How many cars can we actually hold?
I'm going to have to take a little issue. I think we have to plan for this. You're right. People are not going to give up their cars. I mean, we may get some people, and I think it's going to be a little of off. I know when my son went to MU, he parked the equivalent of probably 5 or 6 city blocks away just for his dorm. But people are going to have their cars. People are going to want their cars. When you see urban areas develop, they develop with parking in them. I work in cities outside of Columbia, and we're going to have to pay a little more attention to on-site parking. If we're going to go up, we're going to have some of that parking integrated into the buildings, I think, or we're going to be in trouble.
Well, and when there are garages, I'm glad that the city has done projects where, again, the first floor had commercial or active uses. I think that's key. Whether they're public or private garages, I think we need to have active uses on the first level.
The new one across from the post office is the only one of the city garages that has that, though, right? The older ones are just parking garages.
Right, and our board lobbied long and hard to get commercial on the bottom of garages. I think Short Street is going to have that as well as kind of a new model. I think right now, when you look at it, the city is providing parking for district shoppers and residents and diners. And that's something that they do because they see that as an economic development tool. It helps downtown, which is a great economic generator. But the question is how many garages can the city build and where can they put them in order to really cover the needs of all the new residential complexes?
Well, and again, when you're talking about students, I don't know why we have to. I mean, I was glad as a father of a student going to a way to college that I didn't have to provide them with a car, that there was good public transportation. There were plenty of offerings within that downtown area and actually all over Minneapolis, but most certainly in the area that my son spent most of his time. So I'm not saying we don't need garages, but I am saying that, again, balance. We need to figure out a way to create a culture where people are using buses, and it's not going to happen until we actually have the appropriate routes, because that's the problem right now.
Okay, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA, the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about downtown Columbia, and we're going to take a short break. We hope you'll stick around. Welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the future of downtown Columbia. Joining me in the studio are Carrie Gartner, the executive director of the Downtown Community Improvement District, John Ott, a developer and owner of several downtown properties, and Debbie Shields, a historic preservation consultant. For those of you in the audience, are there things about down in particular that you think ought to be changed or that ought to be preserved? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. We have a caller on the line, I believe. Ken from Columbia. Ken, are you with us?
Sure am.
Great. Thanks for joining the program today and for calling in.
There used to be several sidewalk benches up and down 9th Street and Broadway, and I and many of my friends missed them. Most of these have disappeared. Can anyone on your panel say why these benches were removed?
Carrie, we'll throw that to you.
I can. A lot of them were relocated. If you'll notice down on 10th Street and over in the North Village Arts District, which didn't have a lot of amenities, we relocated a lot of benches there. There were some problems associated with the benches. People were being harassed by individuals who sat on benches. They were being graffitied in the high traffic areas. They're actually performing the way they should over in the North Village Arts District. People are sitting on them waiting for tables and restaurants and so forth. So that's why they were moved.
Mm-hmm. Ken, does that answer the question?
Sort of. It's a roundabout way. I think there are other ways of dealing with, I assume she's talking about vagrants and homeless people. I think there are ways of dealing with them without just simply taking the benches away.
What would you like to see happen?
That's a difference of opinion. If a person who is sitting on the bench or using the bench is considered a nuisance, then I assume you would call the police. If they're not being a nuisance while sitting on the bench, then they're just if they're behaving themselves, what's the problem?
Okay. Ken, thanks for calling in and adding your thoughts to today's conversation.
Excuse me, one more.
Yeah, of course.
Most of the towns that I visit seem to have them, and they apparently must be dealing with the problem in other ways.
Okay. So
I do miss the benches. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thanks again for calling in and sharing your thoughts. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we do have an aggressive panhandling ordinance. What we found is that a lot of people are unwilling to press charges when officers are called. For one reason or another.
Well, and I recall a couple of different times we discussed this a lot, and we had some retailers that were just crying for the bench to be removed in front of their door. There'd be people that would be walking down one side of the street and see a cluster of people around a bench that that they were concerned about, and so they'd cross the street and they'd avoid the door to their store. So. I personally felt like those retailers needed relief from that particular thing happening. I supported the idea that the benches be moved. I know. And I don't know really that there was a lot the police could do. And unless you're sitting there watching the bench, physically watching the people on the bench all day long, and they can't afford to do that. They have to move around, it was a difficult thing to deal with.
Okay, I want to move back to something we were talking about before the break, in terms of the car traffic downtown, because I don't think we've completely covered that. We have a comment in the chat room from Clayton who says, "You know, downtown looks woefully unprepared for traffic that will occur because of SEC football games." One of many things that happen downtown or near downtown that potentially would be an issue. We've talked about the residents and their cars downtown, but what about all the people who come downtown if downtown is the center of activity? How do we deal with that?
Well, we do a lot of events like a Roots and Blues or a True False where you have a lot of people that come into the district. And what we don't want to do is build the infrastructure, i.e. parking lots, to deal with top population days. So you cannot have enough parking lots for all the SEC fans in downtown because they'll just be vacant concrete the rest of the year. But I know the city is working very hard on parking plans in conjunction with the university, in conjunction with us, in terms of where do we put folks? Where do we put RVs? From our understanding is there are a lot of folks that drive to SEC games in RVs. So where do they go? I mean, they simply can't come and park in a parking garage. So there's some issues that are being addressed. I agree. It's they've got a whole parking plan that they're working
well,
on.
Well, but
they sure. Meaning
The university and the city, and they've been working with the city special events committee to really talk about parking.
Right.
But traffic is not just parking. It's also people getting through town, and I think we do have some issues with that. Broadway's getting really congested, and when you get a lot of pedestrians downtown, someone waiting to make a turn for the sidewalk to clear can go through a whole signal.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've talked about that
yes.
before, is that Broadway is one of the only through streets, and that's something that needs to be addressed. And I think hopefully will be in – needs to be looked at is how can we get cars off of Broadway? How can we get traffic through downtown a little more efficiently? Because if you get clogged up there, then it really locks up the whole downtown.
So. There are only – we need to look at the entire street grid. There are only two through streets that go east and west, Walnut and Broadway. Mm-hmm. So all the traffic goes to Walnut and Broadway rather than these other – streets that they could be shuttled off to.
Right.
So
and one of the plans suggested that, right? Taking Elm Street all the way through, or Locust, or one of those two.
Looking at Elm.
Yeah, taking Elm Street through. And I think they were, I don't know where that's at. I know they were looking at the historic nature of the buildings.
They surveyed that neighborhood, and I haven't seen anything lately. You know, and that's one of those things to look at again, and I thought that was a good idea, but I drive Elm Street a lot, and that's a narrow street with a lot of pedestrians from the university, so... You know, those things that look good on paper take a whole lot more planning. But we probably do need another one, especially one south of Broadway. There's just – it's hard to get in and out.
Yeah, we have a lot of streets that don't go through. They're blocked for one reason or another.
Right. I want to move on to another part of this. We have an email that came in that sort of gets at another part of the discussion that we might want to talk about here. The email, you know, talks about these new student apartment complexes and calls them urban canyons being created because of the height of the buildings and that they go basically right to the sidewalks here. And so the person who emailed this in says, why in the world the city doesn't require floor area ratio to open up space for new development is beyond me. To place a building right up to the sidewalk without green space is making the city too urban and ugly, is what the emailer says. We are losing the beauty and the human scale. We need to use smart growth principles in development. So that's an email that came in. Can you talk a little bit about that in terms of, you know, the choices that get made on these new construction projects and what would make for downtown to fit the goals of that walkable and comfortable and sort of human component that we talked about at the beginning of the show?
Zero setbacks is downtown development. And if you look at cities that do form-based codes, their downtown has zero lot lines. No setbacks. And that's what we think of when we think of downtown. We think of the sidewalk, the lively sidewalk and the pedestrians and the businesses right up to that. The areas of downtown that don't work for pedestrians are the ones where there's a huge parking lot or a huge setback in between the sidewalk and the business. So in that sense, that is downtown development. That's building up, building to the sidewalk is traditional downtown development.
Keeping retail on that ground floor, that's even
yeah.
more important if you're going to have those canyons, that the ground floor is an active, interactive type of business so that when you're walking down the street, there's something going on besides a closed
and
window.
That's the solution, I think, rather than a setback that doesn't match downtown development style is commercial on the bottom floor.
And are buildings required to have commercial on the ground floor? Because two of the new apartment buildings don't. They have windows that are actually not even at window height because the building is partially underground.
I know.
So you kind of have these windows at waist level.
Not required.
And that's where, you know, I would make the case that we in the future we should be looking in an area zone C2 that we be looking at commercial uses on the first floor anyway. I mean, I think it's critical for the health and the vibrance of downtown. The other thing is this design. You mentioned, you know, the canyon effect. Well, I think some of that can be offset by good design, you know, just is good design, period. And you can do some things with the corners of your building. You can use materials that make it feel less like a canyon and makes you feel better. And, you know, you can go to other college towns or other communities where they're doing building projects like this. And you know, I got to salute some of our leaders that are going to other communities and looking for answers to things that we haven't found answers for. I know we've done that for transportation. They're working on that. They've done it for the airport. You know, maybe that's what ought to happen now. Maybe we ought to go to some communities and find out what they're doing as it relates to design and their urban center.
Let's talk about that for a second. What is the process? I mean, we have sort of plans that are put forth by consultants that say this would be really nifty if your downtown does some of these things. And then, you know, what happens between that and the time that a building now is renting apartments? What is the process between there, and what would need to change in order to do what you're saying, John, to have more design thought going into some of this stuff?
Now, Deb, you've done design guidelines before in cities, or you're familiar with the process.
Design guidelines are very useful and potentially very confrontational. They're very difficult to manage, so it's often a growing pain, and that is what historic preservation is, essentially, is working with design guidelines. But those apply to new construction as well, just a different set. So some of that can be handled just through zoning, and it's almost time for us to start looking at zoning. If C2, you know, should that require retail on the ground floor? Should that require some parking for the tenants? It's a really fine line of how you manage that without trampling on individual property rights, which is essentially what any kind of zoning is that balance. It's property management. It's just how do we do it? We haven't done it yet. Is the appetite there? That's, you know, maybe something that follows with this much construction. It's time to start looking at that.
And what is there now? I mean, John, you've been through some of this process as a developer, right? What hoops do developers have to go through already that are, you know, some might say are cumbersome to begin with without even putting on these architectural things?
I mean, the things that most developers have the greatest frustration with is just the international building codes, and some of these codes are updated every year, sometimes by lobbyists of construction companies. So you're having to deal with things that you wonder why you're having to deal with. There's supposed to be life safety issues, and for example, we were having to put a water fountain, you know, on a very small office building. You know, it had three rooms. We had to have a water fountain there. We had a sink there, but had to have a water fountain there, and it also had to be of two heights. And you're saying, well, are there people dying of thirst in Columbia? I'm not sure. But you have to have building codes, and for the most part, those are just fine. But, you know, I think some people would appreciate having some design guidelines. I guess it's a matter to what extent do you do this, and it might even make the process easier. I think Skip Walther, in an article this past weekend in the Saturday Tribune business section, talked about potentially that we ought to consider design standards. And again, I don't know what that means necessarily. I think we ought to see what other communities are doing. But if developers have at least some guidelines, it might save them time and some headaches with some organizations that maybe don't like, you know, what they're doing. If there's some guidelines up front that people had some input into and that everyone says, oh, it's reasonable, perhaps then that'll make the building process go more smoothly. And that's always a good thing.
That can help a lot. And being specific, it's been my experience with preservation that the more specific you are, the clearer it is for everybody. If you say, use an appropriate color, for example, well, who decides what appropriate means? But if you say, you know, use X, Y, or Z specifically, then the reviewer knows it, the builder knows it, the city code official knows it. So if you can get specific enough without being too restrictive, then it's an easier set of guidelines to manage. And I always see that in preservation, because I see sometimes things go in as local ordinances with a certain group of people who know exactly what they mean, and it doesn't really matter what's written. Well, 20 years down the road, they're all gone, and somebody else is trying to interpret that, and it can be very tangled. So doing design guidelines takes enough specificity so you know what you're doing, but not so much that everything's going to look exactly the same.
Right. So. And the key is, if you negotiate the design standards at the beginning of the process with everybody involved, and you have a rule book, That's much better than kind of an ad hoc design committee that comes in after the project's been designed and saying, a little more to the left, a little more to the right. I mean, that's just a nightmare for developers, yeah. And that's what really kind of shuts down development. So what you want to do is encourage the right type of development for a downtown urban area, but you want to make sure that there's not this onerous sort of ad hoc process that you kind of place on the developers.
So when you walk in as a developer, you
everyone
say, if I meet A, B, and C, I can get this done. Not, I'll put my plans in and see what comes up and what objections there are, and then we'll work with those, and then we'll see what other objections come up. And that kind of uncertainty is very expensive and very off-putting and can be
designed by committee.
Yeah. A lot of camels.
Okay, again, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the future of downtown Columbia. Joining me in the studio are Carrie Gardner, the executive director of the Downtown Community Improvement District, John Ott, a developer and owner of several downtown properties, and Debbie Shields, a historic preservation consultant. For those of you in our audience, if you have ideas for downtown Columbia, we would love to hear those. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Debbie, I want to ask you specifically, if you were writing a set of guidelines for Columbia, what would you want to see in them at this point? You grew up here for most of your upbringing. You are now working with other towns. What would you want to see in those guidelines exactly?
I think, you know, I've already mentioned, I think retail on the ground floor is absolutely essential. We end up with dead streets. I think we've got to take a look at how parking is handled. Those are really the big things. Some design guidelines, really the development patterns that were set historically have open spaces on the ground floor, maybe not retail but office, but the ground floors are historically and currently in urban areas a fairly public function. And then as you get further up, they're less public. They can be apartments or offices. So the way you can put that together, that doesn't mean every new building should look like an old building. In fact, they shouldn't. They're new construction. They should look like that. But those patterns of use that have been developed and have worked for hundreds of years in American cities are still very much relevant and something that we should look at. So, you know, patterns of use can be as important as what that exact building looks like. They kind of play off of each other.
Right. And how would you write that into something that someone who's developing a piece of property would understand and be able to know that that's what's expected and go off of?
Well, that was pretty clear the way you just put it.
Well, I mean,
what
you articulated is some
and you get
guidelines
actual
on patterns of use. But what would the patterns of use be? Like, would you say there needs to be X percentage of the ground floor is lobby public space with X minimum ceiling atrium height or anything like that? That specific or
sometimes
not?
Sometimes you get that specific. And that's part of what I have to do is sometimes you have to do things like, you know, no less than 70% of this wall is going to be windows or open so that we don't have people walking by a brick wall, and then that lets people have that flexibility. Upper stories can be, you know, more enclosed but should have so many features. You know, some cities look at even in that canyon effect that the person mentioned can go with changing wall materials. You know, so many, if you have 15 stories, you should have a variety of wall materials so it doesn't look like a flat wall. So, and those are the things that you do with much back and forth. So you can still give people enough flexibility that they can design their own building.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think that would fly, John?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. But I do think that when people are seeking new zoning, if you already own a piece of C2 property, you might say, well, wait a minute, you know, you're changing the rules on me. I've owned this and I shouldn't have to play by a different set of rules. But if somebody's coming to the city or the community and saying, hey, I want to take this other zoning and I want to convert it to C2 and I just want to do anything I want to do, and that's what you're going to get, well, then maybe that's the time where you say, well, you know, here are some things that that the community has said, as well as other developers have said, these are reasonable considerations, use and design, and when you do these things, we're going to have a much better downtown area, and will you go along with that? And so, and if you go along with that, we'll give you the zoning you need. So I think that's how it ought to work, maybe.
That's a fair way to do it.
And we're talking in terms of regulation. There's also incentives. I mean, that's another way that you can really guide development. Historic preservation tax credit, the federal and the state, is a perfect example of an incentive. They say we will give you money if you redo your building to these standards, and people say, deal. So it's a positive way to get a building to look the way you want it to. So there are all sorts of ways to do that. I'm sure some
carrots can be more fun than sticks.
Yeah.
And how important was that in the redevelopment work you've done, John? Because you've rehabbed and brought back to life several buildings in Columbia.
Well, when we did when we redeveloped historic buildings, we could not have done it without the historic tax credits that were available. Because of the condition those buildings were in, many people, you know, would have considered tearing them down, doing something else. But in our case, you know, to meet the current codes and to really put them into to use the way we wanted to, you have to use those credits, and it's a great program. But by the way, and I agree, the incentives are good. In the case of the zoning example, the carrot is the new zoning. But yeah, I hope that we have other incentives available for developers so that we get excellent development. I mean I think that, again, because we have such a wonderful opportunity with the colleges surrounding the downtown area and then the neighborhoods surrounding the downtown area, that the space that we have, we really should value it and pay a lot of attention to how it's done without putting a load on the developers. I think, again, let's look at what other communities do who have done it successfully and pattern ourselves after that.
And we need to pay attention. I mean, these buildings last 100 years, so a little care now is going to help for a long time. It's, you know, that's why you plan, so that you don't end up with a mess that then you have to put up with for a long time. Buildings are expensive. If we're building up, they're going to be especially expensive, so we have to pay attention.
Mm-hmm. It raises another question, what John was saying in terms of the zoning as the carrot. You give the zoning. What happens after that? So we talked a little bit about this earlier as well, that, you know, the buildings don't always match the renderings. And sometimes it can be quite surprising what comes out after we thought we were getting something, and then, you know, a few stories get added onto that parking garage is one example. A lot of people might throw up is, you know, the original drawings for the big garage by the post office weren't quite as tall, for example, and then it grew in the construction phase. There are other examples of that as well, both downtown and elsewhere in Columbia, right, to be fair. But what's going on in terms of that issue in Columbia? Is there a process where buildings have to go through a review and something happens if they don't match what was presented?
No. I mean, am I correct? I you're right about renderings. I mean, every rendering I've ever seen has 40-year-old oak trees outside.
Right. They just take the trees off.
And it softens any type of building.
It does. It looks great.
I know. It looks wonderful. So, like, when I'm an old lady walking downtown, I'll think, this is what it looked like.
There you go.
But that is something. I mean, they could require larger trees be put in with these properties, and instead there's young trees as opposed to mature trees, right?
You know, then there's the payoff. You know, do we need low-income housing? Do we charge for bigger trees?
Right. Yeah.
It's a very complicated
process.
But right now we don't have anything that says, you know, your rendering said you were going to put stone here and you ended up with stucco, as far as I know.
And if it's zoned, if they have just a standard zoning, then they're not required to meet any kind of necessarily any design standard. If it's zoned in, I think, CP, then sometimes they have made commitments or agreements to some design things. Mm-hmm. And in that case, they should be meeting their requirements. I don't know. I don't know how the city handles that particular issue. But just in open zoning, I'm not aware of any kind of requirements to meet any design standards. Period.
We have sign standards.
We do have some signs.
Yeah, very precise, right? I remember when those passed.
Size-wise, to really kind of prevent that crazy 1960s.
And that was the same kind of thing. And that wasn't, you know, your sign can only be black and white, which some communities do. But it was really? Like your sign can be X square feet if you're going to put it here. Or, you know, it shouldn't be this far. So that was a good exercise in how difficult it can be and how helpful it can be. And that's the same thing as a lot of people when we did the sign said, well, why don't we just wait until it's a problem? Well, then you have people that have spent thousands of dollars on signs that don't want to take them down and shouldn't have to. So.
Well, and the sign ordinance, I think, has worked very well. In fact, it allowed other – it allowed more creativity. It allowed the extension signs.
So the projecting signs that brought –
Yeah, it
like
allowed to do
signs.
The sidewalk sandwich boards, which some people were doing illegally before, but they're allowed. And so it kind of brought our sign ordinance up to date for a downtown, a vibrant downtown area.
Yeah. It was a good example of how it can work.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the parts of that is that if you can't think of everything when you do these types of things, and so that's why you have a variance board, and you can seek a variance if something wasn't thought out well enough, and I know there have been a couple of occasions where that was the case, and the board accepted the change. So.
Right. I want to come back to that issue of an open zoning, and the building can be sort of whatever the owner or builder wants to make it. Is Columbia's way of handling that consistent with other communities that you've worked with, Debbie?
I think so. I rarely see, especially downtowns, where, everything is prescribed because, like John said, you can't figure out every eventuality, and you probably shouldn't. Right. That would be pretty boring.
But in terms of architectural standards, I mean, if Columbia were to try to implement some kind of architectural standard on new construction, how different would that make Columbia from other communities?
I don't think terribly. I mean, there are plenty of communities that have design standards, new and old. And I see historic standards that work in varying degrees of success or ease, in the same thing probably with new standards. So it's certainly done. Mm-hmm. The challenge is flexibility,
right,
and clarity.
Right. We just have a little bit of time left. Carrie, I just want to give you the last opportunity here. What else is in store for downtown that people can look forward to in the coming years?
You know, what's just very exciting is that we're really doing a lot of development in previously underutilized places, not just historic renovation, a lot of infill development, a lot of repurposing buildings. So old grocery stores become art galleries and old roofing companies become studios. So that's what's very exciting. What I really think we're moving towards is getting more linkages between these neighborhoods within the district. There was a time when Flat Branch wasn't considered part of downtown. So we're linking to them. We're linking to the North Village Arts District. Really looking at the district as a whole and encouraging people to make those pedestrian connections between the areas.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We're going to have to stop there. I'd like to thank our guest, Carrie Gartner, the executive director of the Downtown Community Improvement District, John Ott, a developer and owner of several properties downtown, and Debbie Shields, a historic preservation consultant. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. There you will be able to watch a video feed of our program and participate in an online chat with others in the audience. You can also add your comments, and you will find a video archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's show was produced by Raymond Tungekar. Travis McMillan is our studio director, with production assistance from Danny Madison. I'm Ruben Stern. Thanks for joining us.